You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 390, Revelation 17 and 18. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you feeling?
Well, it's been a pretty good day. I mean, the days aren't all equal. Some of that is because I can't eat. What's going to rip me isn't, you know, all that good stuff that we look forward to as we age. Yeah. So, you know, have it thrust on me now and before it's time, but here we are.
Yeah. Well, have you at least been able to rest and watch some baseball and all that good stuff?
Yeah. I've been doing that, sleeping a lot. So I think I'm caught up from the hospital experience, which, you know, this is not a slight against anybody who actually works in a hospital, but I'm convinced Vlad the Impaler made the beds that they use in hospitals. It's his patent, because they are just unbelievably uncomfortable. Just crazy. Yeah. You know, where I was at, they had this, I actually made a video of it because I couldn't believe it. But you tilt the bed up and it forms a gully, like at the hinge. Like, well, that can't be right. Yeah. So it's like you throw like three or four pillows in there, you sit on top of them, and you can just about get comfortable. Because I mean, I have lower back problems, you know, since high school. Okay. So this is an issue for me. And then when you're settled, the bed moves. It moves like every 4 or 5 minutes or whatever it is. And it's, you know, for people who are bedridden, you know, for bed sores and change positions and all this. But it's like, what in the world? It's like you can't get comfortable. So I asked the one nurse, you know, like, can you just unplug this thing? She didn't know how. Well, I figured it out. And I didn't ask permission either.
Yeah.
I did. I dismantled the thing. You know, it's like, you know, I've got to be able to at least get, I was getting maybe 3 hours of sleep, you know, a night, you know, plus all the beeping and the tests and it's almost like they want you to want to leave. Yeah. Like you had me at the first night. We don't need to continue. I want to leave.
Yeah. At least you're over that piece of it and you're able to eat now. So that's good. Taste some things and at least you're on that side of it.
Yeah. I have not had any kind of stomach problem, you know, as far as nausea or anything like that. I mean, I still get pain, you know, like, you know, gas pain and stuff like that when you're reintroducing, you know, food, but you know, that'll get figured out. You know, we're working our way through the grocery list, pun intended, of stuff that, you know, I feel like eating. So it'll get there. I've managed to gain 12 pounds.
That's awesome.
I don't really know how, because I don't right now, I still don't have much of an appetite. I mean, I don't have the nausea problem, but you know, I can eat things, normal things, but not in great amounts. And then sometimes it'll just rip me around. So it's still an experiment, but somehow or another, it's like, how in the world did I gain 12 pounds? You know, a lot of it's the IV stuff, but it's still meaningful because I got to put the weight back on, you know, before chemo. So that's actually been kind of astonishing. Yeah. To step on a scale and like, how did that happen? But there it is, you know.
Yeah, so what you're saying is you're not in the garage pumping iron.
No, we're not there yet.
Oh, okay. All right.
No, we're not there yet.
All right. Well, good deal. Well, yeah. I can only imagine through all of this, how much fun you've had preparing for Revelation 17 and 18.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, these two chapters are, you know, pretty big ones.
Maybe I should hold the rest of Revelation until I'm on like medical marijuana, because that would sort of fit, you know, just.
Yeah, absolutely. We get some good episodes on that. That's great. It's a good idea.
Yeah. My comments at that point would be just as meaningful as anybody else's. So.
I don't know. That's a good experiment. We should try that.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if we'll get there or not, you know, but there we are. You can tell I've been reading about all this stuff that people try, you know, when they hit chemo. And so that has popped up, you know, in 4 or 5 articles I've read. So it's like, Yeah, that'd be good for the rest of the book of Revelation. Why not? You know,
there you go. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm ready for it. This is two chapters that it's lots of stuff going on in these two.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we're going to do 17 and 18 today. And there's a lot of, you know, overlap, and, you know, a good fair number of overlaps between these chapters and stuff we've already hit. So, you know, we're not going to rehearse everything, you know, that we, you know, did before. We're not going to cover all that turf again. So I'm going to pick my spots. For instance, you know, we've talked before about Babylon being a chaos symbol and a metaphor. That was chapter 14. It's going to pop up again here. You know, we've talked about its relationship to Rome, and so we're not going to repeat that material. You know, in this episode, we're going to try to focus on the identity of Mystery Babylon and how it's rooted in, you know, Old Testament descriptions maybe of idolatry and specifically injustice to the nations. And again, if that sounds like Psalm 82, you know, take note of that, because it is kind of surprising, you know, how much, you know, let's put it this way. You know, when you're talking about Babylon and you're talking about a system, because this is the book of Revelation, okay, the city of Babylon itself is not a big deal anymore. There is no Babylonian Empire. So we get John talking about Rome, you know, the big bad empire of its day, the last empire of Daniel 2, you know, because that's when the kingdom of God, you know, comes into the picture during the Roman Empire. I mean, we're very clearly talking about Roman stuff throughout the book of Revelation. So John is going to use Babylon, Old Testament Babylon, as a way to talk about the great enemy that the church is facing. Okay, when he's writing the book of Revelation. Well, everybody sort of knows that, but do we realize what we're talking about when we talk about Babylon as a system? That's the Deuteronomy 32 rebellion. That's the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. And so it shouldn't surprise us that the judgments that are meted out, you know, whether it's the trumpets or the bowls or, you know, whatever set of judgments we're talking about, are judgments on the nations. Their judgments on the people who have aligned themselves with the beast, i.e. with Babylon, with these other nations that are against, not just, you know, not Israel, you know, ethnic Israel in this case, but against, you know, the new Israel of God, i.e. the church. And again, I'm not a total, you know, replacement theologian kind of guy, and my audience knows that. You know, I refer to the church as a new Israel, not the new Israel. I do think there's an eschatological destiny for Israel, geographic Israel. But you have to be thinking in these modes. It makes a lot of sense to read through the book of Revelation. We got judgments against the nations, judgments against the people of those nations, tied up with the day of the Lord, which is when those things happen in the Old Testament. And ultimately, though the gods of the, you know, those nations, supernatural evil, they're going to lose total control. They're going to be destroyed. So they're no longer going to govern the nations. I mean, their authority's already been stripped away. People who've read Unseen Realm or the Demons book already know this. You know, people who, you know, listen to our Colossians, you know, series when we got to Colossians 3, you're going to know that Paul unites the idea of the resurrection with the nullification of the authority of the fallen sons of God of the Old Testament, the gods of the Old Testament, who are Paul's principalities and powers, and so on and so forth. All these things intertwine. And so when you're here in the book of Revelation and you see these judgments being played out the day of the Lord, another element of this that's being described is the final death of the gods. Okay, this is when the judgment of Psalm 82 comes to pass. And these chapters 17 and 18 are leading up to, again, or they're dealing, you know, we've both led up to, and we're now dealing with the fall of Babylon, the fall of Babel, the fall of the whole system, and the death of its gods. You know, that's really going to take place at Armageddon. Because what is Armageddon? It is not a battle at Megiddo. Okay, it is a battle for Zion. It's a battle for the seat of divine authority. It's the Har Mored, the mountain of assembly, the mount of assembly, which in the Old Testament, again, on the pagan side is going to be, you know, Baal's mountain and so on and so forth. But on the Israelite side, on Yahweh's side, this is Zion. This is Jerusalem. This is where the battle is. This is what it's about. This is all stage setting for the ultimate conflict between the Deuteronomy 32 Babel system and Yahweh himself for supremacy. That's what it is. And so when we read through the book of Revelation, you know, those people in this audience who understand what the Deuteronomy 32 worldview is, you ought to be able to, it ought to be jumping out at you in this talk about the nations and the beast and Babylon. I mean, again, how could you miss it? It's just that we're not taught about eschatology in this way. We are taught systems, and those systems are typically applied to, well, what's going on in Russia? What's going on in some other country? You know, we isolate it geographically, you know, or maybe we literalize Babylon. And a literalized Babylon approach is better than a literalized Russia or China approach. I mean, because that makes no sense at all. But this is the way we're typically taught, or we're taught to spiritualize everything where there's really nothing going on boots on the ground here. There's no heaven and earth symbiosis. This is just all ethereal. It's the church against evil in a very abstract, ethereal sense. Because again, if you're the amillennialist or, you know, somebody like that, you're typically in your tradition, you're not thinking about the reclaiming of the nations in real time, just like they were lost. You're not thinking in those modes. And so I'm hoping that as we've gone through 15 and 16 and now Revelation 17 and 18, these things will start to, again, recur in your mind and just jump out at you, because this is really what these chapters are about. They're stage setting for the ultimate conflict over who is the Most High. You know, who is the Most High? Is it going to be the beast and that system, or is it going to be the God of the Bible? So I want to jump in here and just, again, start pecking away at some of the things that we haven't addressed in too much detail to this point, sort of fill in the gaps. So let's just start in chapter 17 with the woman who is the prostitute. Some translations will have harlot. So I'll just read a few verses here. One of the seven angels, this is chapter 17, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute, who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of those of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names." Again, let me just stop there. Full of blasphemous names. Well, blasphemous names, these are spiritual competitors. Okay, they're the names of the gods and the other nations. I mean, they're in the wilderness. This is the realm of the dead in the Old Testament. This is, again, this is cosmic chaos. This is anti-Eden. All these things, all the things that you read about in unseen realm just sort of wind up somewhere and do, you know, in the last few chapters of the book of Revelation. They just do, because they're very cosmic in their orientation. But anyway, I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names. It had seven heads and ten horns. Again, we've seen that before. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, and holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. Now, you know, the spiritual adultery, something real simple like that. I mean, we're not dealing with literal adultery, but adultery is an Old Testament metaphor for idolatry, for spiritual unfaithfulness, for worshiping other gods. Why does it make sense here? Why does it fit here? Because it's Babel. Okay, this is the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. Nothing could make more sense. This is the whole point. It's the gods of the world that are going to be arrayed and aligned against the God of Israel and his people. Okay, that's the end of days scenario. It's the day of the Lord. It's the final judgment of the gods. And it comes down to this one final conflict. Again, what I'm trying to communicate is that the language, the stuff, the fornication stuff, the harlot, the ways in the Old Testament that idolatry and loyalty to some other god, i.e. one of the gods appointed, allotted to the nations back at the Deuteronomy 32 rebellion at the Tower of Babel, this is the way idolatry is described. So it should be no surprise. You know, it should be just, you know, firing off the radar in your head. And the biblical theological Deuteronomy 32 worldview radar should be just, you know, ringing in your head that this is the setting for what, you know, what we're reading, you know, what's going on in these chapters. But again, we're just not taught about end times this way. We're taught some system and then there you go. You know, be warmed and filled, pick your system and away you go. And it's like it's not tied anywhere to an Old Testament worldview or a supernatural worldview context. And again, that's just a shame. You know, how many times have you heard me say that on the podcast? But here we are again. So back to the woman here and the description, seated on many waters, again, the theme of the immorality and so on and so forth. So it's important, again, to, I'm just going to rabbit trail a little bit here. Because one of the things you read is that this is actually, Babel, the beast, is actually a description of Jerusalem. Now I'm just going to say it. I think this is an unfortunate, I'm going to try to be a little kind here. I think this is an unfortunate anti-Semitic trajectory and interpretation. We need to remember from the outset, there's a difference between an unfaithful wife and a prostitute. Okay, those two are on the same page, but they are not the same thing. Really, you know, in most respects, not at all. There's also a difference between the seducer and the one who gets seduced. Okay, so just hold those thoughts. And I'm going somewhere with this, but I want to rabbit trail a little bit on this notion that you know, Babylon here is Israel or Jerusalem. Yeah, I don't think that's the case at all. So Keener writes in his New International NIV application commentary on Revelation, which I don't think we've used to this point before, but I've just been reading through it, and there's a lot of good stuff in here, as you'd expect with Keener. But anyway, the Old Testament prophets, he writes, often portrayed Israel as a woman, either God's faithful bride when pure, for example, Isaiah 54, 5 and 6, Isaiah 62, 5, or Hosea 2, 19 and 20, or as an adulteress when unfaithful to him, unfaithful to God. Leviticus 17, 7, Isaiah 1, 21, Jeremiah 3, 1, Ezekiel 16, 20. Of course, Ezekiel 16 is the big one. Revelation contrasts two cities, Jerusalem and Babylon, as a bride and a prostitute, respectively. So out of the gate, this is not Jerusalem, because the contrast between Babylon and Jerusalem has already been given in the book. We're going to get this in Revelation 17, 5 here, as you're reading a few verses ahead, like we just did. And also Revelation 21, 2, this is going to become clear. So in two Old Testament instances, Keener writes, the prostitute is not Israel, Judah, or Jerusalem, but an evil world empire. So there's Old Testament precedent for the harlot, the prostitute image being used of a world pagan empire. And those two instances were Nineveh and Tyre. Tyre is going to become a little important as we proceed. Back to Keener, he says, Nineveh will seduce the nations with her prostitution and witchcraft, Nahum 3:4. And Tyre will play the prostitute with, quote, all the kingdoms on the face of the earth, Isaiah 23:17. Yet her wealth will ultimately be laid up for the righteous. Let me just stop there. It's the theme of wealth that loops Tyre into this. If you go back to, remember, Ezekiel 28. Okay, Ezekiel 28, the seed of the gods, it's the divine council. It's, you know, we've talked a lot about divine council stuff in there, Eden stuff, the Eden, the mountain of God, the garden of God there in Ezekiel 28. But the other thing that happens in Ezekiel 28 is you get the gemstones, you get terminology for economic wealth and prosperity, and how this is used to bring other nations under the power, under the influence of Tyre, okay, in that chapter. And so that idea of using wealth to entice other nations into relationships and ultimately into idolatrous relationships is going to be part of what's happening here in the book of Revelation. It's going to be part of the description to describe this massive world system. And ultimately, it's going to emerge as the Babel world system, because Babylon is the last power standing that actually succeeds in destroying the people of God in the Old Testament. Tyre doesn't. Egypt didn't. It's going to be Babylon, okay? And again, that ties back very obviously in the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. But again, I'm just throwing stuff out at this point. There are things that are going to pop up in this chapter that they seem not related, but they actually are related. It's seduction, it's idolatry, it's spiritual unfaithfulness, and ultimately it's the Deuteronomy 32 rebellion. So let's go back to Keener. Keener says, some scholars have proposed that Babylon here partly symbolizes Jerusalem. Others suggest it predicts a revived role for a literal Babylon. But especially in view of its place on seven hills, that's going to be verse 9 of chapter 17, most commentators recognize that Rome is in view, whether or not they believe the text also looks beyond Rome, like further into the future. As commentators often also recognize, Babylon the prostitute is a deliberate contrast with the New Jerusalem as the bride. Okay, again, there's this contrastive element. Others also contrasted Zion and Babylon, lamenting Babylon's prosperity, but anticipating its judgment. Second Temple writers do this. Second Baruch 11, Fourth Ezra 3. I mean, this is not new to either Keener or myself or New Testament scholars today. There are going to be Second Temple Jewish writers that see the deliberate contrast prophetically between Babylon and Jerusalem. Now, that's the end of the Keener quote. You could say, okay, you have the prostitute motif used of foreign empires. Okay, that's fair. Keener's given us two examples here. But someone could come back and say, well, Ezekiel 16 describes Israel as a whore, and that's true. Jeremiah 2:20, really through chapter 4, verse 30, does that. But, you know, we need to think a little bit more about what's going on in these passages. On the Jeremiah description, Jeremiah 2 through 4, of Judah as a prostitute, Beale and McDonough note the following. They say, in that passage, Judah is a harlot who has, quote, a harlot's forehead, that's Jeremiah 3:3, and causes others to sin, on whose skirts is found the lifeblood of the innocent, Jeremiah 2:34, whose dress is in scarlet, who decorates herself with ornaments of gold, Jeremiah 4, verse 30, and whose lovers will despise her and try to kill her. Israel is called a harlot because although she is supposedly committed to Yahweh, she has spiritual intercourse with idols. And again, it's idolatry. But there's a problem here. But in Revelation, the point of reference is to a specific city. It's not to a country. It's not to a region. It's to a specific city that seduces others by means of idolatry and injustice. It's not to a country that was seduced by such things like Israel. I mean, Israel is the one who gets seduced. This is, by the way, that's Deuteronomy 32 as well. This is the first time we read in the Torah, you know, where we read of Israel actually getting seduced to worship other gods. It's Deuteronomy 32. I think 10, 11, 12, you know, right around there, we actually get verse 17, of course, where Israel, you know, is blamed for worshiping, you know, gods, the Shadim, and so on and so forth. So Israel is the one who gets caught up in this. They get seduced by the gods of the nations. The gods of the nations come after Yahweh's children to make them disloyal. And so Israel, Judah, whatever, you know, becomes what Babylon already is. Okay, they get seduced by this. They're not the one that is going to go out and seduce other nations. You're not going to have any passage in the Old Testament where Israel or Jerusalem, you know, is going to go out and make the other nations idolaters. They're already idolaters. That doesn't make any sense. So I think we need to be thinking a little bit more about what is actually described in the book of Revelation is a city that has been the engine of chaos, not a victim, not one who's been seduced, like you could say Israel was, but this is the one that drives the bus. This is the one who's driving the idolatry bus. So the reason Israel receives harlot prostitution imagery is because she has become idolatrous. She has been seduced, not because she lures other nations into that condition. The prostitute of Revelation 17 is not a victim. The prostitute of Revelation 17 is the engine of chaos. And that just isn't Jerusalem. It makes no sense. So Beale and McDonough again chime in. They say, despite, you know, some of these references to Judah, okay, or Ezekiel 16, whatever, they say a harlot can also refer to other ungodly nations in the prophets, as in Isaiah 23, 15 through 18, Nahum 3, 4 and 5. They mention one Dead Sea Scroll text that applies the Nahum text to other apostates, even within, you know, Israel. But again, the Old Testament precedent for this is other nations. They comment that the harlot metaphor has the essential idea of an illicit relationship, whether that be religious, economic, political, or a combination of these. In both Nahum 3 and especially Isaiah 23, Nineveh and Tyre are called harlots because they ruin and they spread uncleanness among the nations by economically dominating them and influencing them by their idolatry. Furthermore, the whore in Revelation 17 is called specifically, explicitly, Babylon the Great, which refers to Babylon, okay, not Jerusalem, but Babylon. And, you know, by extension, it's going to be Rome because that's the enemy of the time. Therefore, Babylon refers both to the pagan world and apostate Israel and to the apostate church. Anybody who cooperates with the Babel system is committing spiritual idolatry. But the great whore herself is Babylon. She is the one, again, she's the engine of chaos, the engine of anti-Eden, the one driving, you know, the one propelling the ruination of all nations and especially targeting the people of Yahweh to turn against him, you know, as sort of the final end game of the Deuteronomy 32 rebellion. Now, there are other reasons why, and that are more obvious, why the prostitute wouldn't be Jerusalem as well. I'm just going to run through these real quickly. The other imagery describing her, again, the prostitute, clearly belongs to either Babylon from the Old Testament or, again, Rome by extension in John's own time period, but not to Jerusalem. So here's a few examples. One, most obviously, the woman is identified as Babylon the Great. Okay, that's takes kind of the ambiguity out of it. Number two, Babylon is said to be drunk with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. That's verse 6 in Revelation 17. Now, earlier in the book, the martyrdom of the faithful is associated with the material in Daniel fulfilled through Antiochus IV, again, the little horn, the Antichrist figure, who is a Gentile. While Jews did kill Christians, you know, Acts 7 with Stephen, for example, this does happen in the book of Acts. There were no full-scale persecutions of Christians anywhere near the level of Roman persecution in New Testament times. There just weren't. Yeah, you can tell Saul to go to Damascus and take Christians captive. You know, what is he going to do? Bring a few dozen with him? Okay, we're talking massive scale, concerted, empowered, funded, you know, persecution by an empire of believers. Okay, you don't get that with the Jewish communities. I mean, it's very localized and sporadic and sparse and so on. I mean, again, you read about this stuff in the book of Acts where somebody gets beaten or, you know, they get shunned from the synagogue. And okay, that obviously that stuff happens. That is not the kind of scale of persecution that is being described in the book of Revelation for Babylon, for the great whore. It's nowhere close. Third, Babylon is described as a city whose people dwell by many waters. Now, Beale notes that this particular point of description about end time Babylon and her judgment is Jeremiah 13, which if you do follow along in the Septuagint, actually Jeremiah 28:13 in the Septuagint. That you say, well, how in the world can it be 30 chapters different? In in some of the major prophets, the numbering, the sequence of the prophets and the chapters in those prophets is dramatically different than you get in the traditional Masoretic text. So that's why. If you read my book, The Bible Code Myth, you would learn that in an appendix. Anyway, the description is taken from Jeremiah 51, Masoretic text, Jeremiah 28, the Septuagint, where Jeremiah predicts absolute judgment on historical Babylon. Quote, "For his, that is God's wrath, is against Babylon to destroy it utterly, against the inhabitants of Babylon dwelling on many waters." So right there it is. And that's actually the Septuagint, Jeremiah 28, 11 through 13. Now, Beale and McDonough note in this regard as well, this many waters description and some of the other descriptors here. They say that the fact that the phrase "fallen, fallen is Babylon" of Isaiah 21 appears in the book of Revelation in the next chapter, Revelation 18, verse 2, as well as in the preceding text earlier in the book, Revelation 14, 18, which itself looks ahead to chapter 17 and 18, where we are today. That fact again points to the fact that we're talking about Babylon itself, not Jerusalem or something like that. Isaiah 21:1 uniquely combines the apparent disparate images of desert and sea. Now, I'm going to go back and read just a few things here. I'm going to read Revelation 17, the verses, a couple of the verses that we read already, just so that you follow Beale and McDonough's point here. So the chapter starts out, "One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, 'Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with the kings of the earth,' so on and so forth." And then verse 3 says, "He carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast." So you get the waters. How can the woman be on many waters and then also be into a wilderness where she's sitting? And Beale and McDonough say what's happening here is John is taking two items from the Old Testament, Isaiah 21:1, Isaiah 21:9, and combining them and using them both here. So let me just read Isaiah 21:1. I'm going to actually go, let me just look this up real quickly in the Septuagint, since that's basically what John is going to be doing here. So Isaiah 21:1, "As a squall might pass through a desert, coming from a desert out of a land, fearsome is the vision and harsh. It was reported to me," so on and so forth. He's going to go off against the Elamites and the Persians and so on and so forth. And you get down to verse 9, when the prophet is, again, railing against these other nations. He says, I'll go to verse 8. "The Lord said, I stood through every day, and I stood over the camp the whole night. And look," here's verse 9, "he himself is coming, a rider of a pair of horses. And he answered and said, 'Fallen, fallen is Babylon, and all its statues and its handiworks have been crushed to the earth.'" So there you have in Isaiah 21:1 and 9, you have this desert idea, and then you have the many waters idea. And so again, there's only really, Beale and McDonough would say, we know where both images are found in the same chapter in the Old Testament about Babylon. And the fact that John uses them both here pretty much tells us really clearly that John's talking about Babylon, not Jerusalem or some other place. Okay. Isaiah 17. In Isaiah 17, 12 through 13, we might as well just throw that in here as well. Beale does not mention this, but I'm going to just loop it in here. So this is, again, one of the oracles against the nations. This is a general one, "Woe to the nations." I'm going to just read you these two verses. "Woe to you, multitude of many nations. You will be troubled like a swelling sea, and the back of many nations will resound like water. Many nations are like much water, as when much water rushes with force." Okay, so there you go. You have the equation of many nations with many waters. And so when the prostitute in Revelation 17 is sitting upon many waters, and later on in the chapter, both in chapter 17 and 18, the judgments are against many nations. Again, this is Babylon. This is the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. When you think Babylon, you should think the fallen sons of God, the fallen gods of the nations of the Old Testament that emerged from the same rebellion at the Tower of Babel. And so this is why we would expect the great beast, the great prostitute, you know, all these images, sitting upon many waters and many nations, all of these things are, they go together. You know, it's sort of like a recipe for chaos. If you think about it, the desert, okay, well, that's anti-Eden. It's completely 180 degrees away from what Eden was. Because deserts are places where you die. They don't have enough food, enough water. They're terrible. You know, you suffer there. Well, that's anti-Eden. Okay, many waters. Well, we don't live in the seas. We don't live in the waters. You know, these are scary. They're unpredictable. Humans can't live there. It's the force of death. It's one of these great, you know, metaphors of the Old Testament. Yeah, it's exactly what Eden wasn't. And all these things, even though to our eye they look like, what in the world is this guy trying to say? He's talking about waters. He's talking about deserts. He's talking about prostitution. He's talking about a beast that comes from the waters and it's got all these heads and all these nations and crowns. And what in the world is all of these things actually go together? Because they're all ways to describe the Deuteronomy 32 worldview, where all the nations of the world are under dominion of other gods who hate Yahweh and his people. It's actually very simple. What we're reading in here in these chapters in Revelation and elsewhere is that the pieces are disassembled and the pieces get talked about individually. But when you put all the pieces together, they make sense when they're together because this is what they describe. Going on again with the list of again, why we don't have Jerusalem here. Jerusalem doesn't have seven hills, neither does Babylon. And that's fine because Rome does. Rome is described that way in coinage and, you know, other primary sources of the period and where John's living. Again, it's a way for John to draw attention to Rome while he's using Babylon language to unite the two. Again, they're anti-Eden, the forces of chaos. Another one, the description of the beast in Revelation 17, upon which the prostitute rides, derives from Daniel 7. Okay, if we look at Daniel 7, the fourth beast is the one whose destruction is prophesied, you know, there in Daniel 7 that bears a resemblance to Revelation 17. But think about Daniel. The fourth beast of Daniel 7 is the one who, you know, persecutes faithful Israelites and Jews. And that one is analogous to the fourth kingdom of Daniel 2. And it's in the fourth kingdom, the time of the fourth kingdom, in that series of four Gentile empires, you know, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, okay? The fourth kingdom is, you know, very obviously Rome. It's not Jerusalem. The fourth kingdom isn't Jerusalem. The fourth kingdom gets destroyed by the kingdom made without hands, the kingdom of God. When do we see the kingdom of God inaugurated, re-inaugurated on earth? That would be during the time of Jesus, which is, of course, is during the time of the Roman Empire. Again, all these things fit, even though it gets confusing when you're looking at individual pieces. Another one, Revelation 17, 15. Let's go read that. The angel said to me, it can't be any clearer than this. The waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. Where do we get those? Deuteronomy 32, Babel, Tower of Babel incident. So in light of the explicit clarity there, it's very evident in Revelation 17 and what's going to follow in Revelation 18 should be understood in the context of the Babel rebellion, the Babel chaos failure at the heart of Deuteronomy 32. Another one, Revelation 17, 12 has roots in the Septuagint back into Daniel 4 and Daniel 7. That can only point to Babylon. So what does Revelation 17, 12 say? The 10 horns you saw are 10 kings that have not yet received royal power. They are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour. Here's the phrase, for 1 hour. Hold on to that. Together with the beast. These are of one mind and they hand over their power and authority to the beast. So Beal and McDonough write in this regard, they say, as Daniel 7, 4 through 7 was the source of the seven heads, so Daniel 7, 7 through 8, and verses 20 and 24 are the source of the 10 horns. And all you got to do is read through Daniel 7 and you'll see that. Daniel identifies the horns with kings, and Revelation 17, 12 does the same. as it begins to reveal further details about how that prophecy will be fulfilled. The king's future reign with the beast will last for a period referred to as 1 hour. The time period echoes that given in Daniel 4:17 in the Septuagint, where it refers to the period during which God caused King Nebuchadnezzar to become like a beast. Okay, the same language is used. Here also, God is sovereign even over the authority of ungodly kings who ally with the beast in order to prepare to oppose the Messiah. The phrase 1 hour is repeated in chapter 18, Revelation 18, with reference to the time in which, quote, Babylon the Great, unquote, was judged by God. It's Revelation 18:10, Revelation 18:17 and 19, which is a combination or which is a combined allusion to the 1 hour from Daniel 4:17. So, you know, essentially what you have here is, well, let me just throw one last one in here. In Revelation 17:18 excludes Jerusalem, but fits Babylon and Rome very well. Let me just read that. Revelation 17:18. The woman you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. Okay, at no time did Jerusalem have dominion over the kings of the whole earth. You could say that about Babylon. You could say that about Rome. Again, given the nations that were in the biblical worldview and the Mediterranean context and all that. Again, it's very clear that the beast is Babylon. Okay, the woman, you know, it's all Babylon, applied to, used as a cipher, or used as a symbolic pool by which to talk about Rome. This should all be just explicitly clear. There's nothing that would loop Jerusalem, you know, into this description as the beast or as the great prostitute or anything like that. So I've spent a lot of time on this again because I want you to see that chapters 15, 16, 17, and 18 are setting up a final conflict between God and the Babel system. It's not between God and Jerusalem. Okay, the final battle, you know, Armageddon is going to be fought at Zion, at Jerusalem, but they are not, that isn't God's enemy. God's enemy here is, again, the Deuteronomy 32 thing, the nations of the world and all that align themselves with the beast who controls the nations of the world and has seduced the nations of the world into worshiping him, okay? So, this is going to be, as we proceed into chapters 19 and especially 20, you're probably already thinking, well, isn't this scene, this whole scene, this whole setup sounds like what's going to happen in chapter 20. How can it be happening here? Okay, because again, if you're asking that question, you've been taught to read the book of Revelation in linear fashion. What we're going to see when we get to Revelation 19 and 20, especially 20, we may hit it in 19. I'm still not sure how I want to do those chapters. But you're going to see that Revelation 20 is actually a condensed version of stuff we've seen before in the book. Okay. This goes back to, should we read Revelation as a linear chronology of events? Or do things in the book repeat themselves in cycles? Okay, that's one of the interpretive problems or controversies in the book of Revelation. And I actually think the truth is, well, it does both. It just depends where you're at, rather than pick a system. Because again, the system will say, well, it only does this, and therefore we're amillennialists. Or no, it's a linear chronology, therefore we're pre-trib, pre-mill, whatever, you know. Look, both of them happen, and I'm going to show you when we get to chapters 19 and 20, again, specifically how one passage in the Old Testament, it's going to be Ezekiel 38 and 39, how that gets repurposed in these chapters, 17, 18, 19, 20, to show you that John is using that to describe a repetitive cycle of events. So there are going to be those who say, well, if you take it that way, then there is no millennium. Meredith Klein is one of those. And I quote him in Unseen Realm. He is very famous. He's one of the, he might be the only evangelical I've ever seen that understand Har Moed, you know, Harmageddon is not Megiddo, but it refers to Jerusalem. Okay, outside evangelicalism, you have scholars that have known this for a long time. But again, evangelicals typically get married to a theological or eschatological system, and they never see this stuff. They're never going back into the Old Testament and you know, looking at the precedent. Well, Klein does, but Klein actually uses it to argue for, I think he's a post-millennialist, or no, not a post, I think he's an amillennialist. I think that's how he uses it. I don't think his conclusion is at all necessary. That'll surprise the guy who reviewed my Demons book in Master's Seminary Journal, who thinks I'm an amillennialist, but that's a subject for a different, you know, podcast. It's amusing how you can be so misread, but when people can't think outside the box, their own boxes, this is what you get. So we're going to get into that. And I already know that some of you are thinking, this just sounds like Revelation 20, where Satan is released and the nations surround Jerusalem. And, you know, that's after the millennium, Mike. That isn't leading up to Armageddon. Well, actually it is. And actually it's describing the same thing. But again, that doesn't mean that we don't have these things actually occurring in real time. And that's what somebody like Klein, you know, who wants to resist because he's committed to a certain end time system that doesn't have a literal kingdom. Okay, I do. And we'll get to that at that point. So I want to stress some of this, that there's a deep connection between chapters 15, 16, 17, 18 with a battle lines being formed. It's all stage setting for Armageddon. And Armageddon is going to be about the nations aligned against God and his people at Jerusalem, just like Revelation 20 describes. Okay, and I just want people to know that you can see it, but then you're going to think that we're reading things out of order because of the way you've been taught to approach the book of Revelation. So I just want to lay that out there. It's both for today and for a subsequent episode. But for the rest of our time today, I don't want to park, you know, on all of that. I want us to think a little bit about, you know, why is it this way? Like what is this sort of leading up to? You know, what's sort of the takeaway point? And here's what I think it is. I think that when we read Revelation 17 and 18 and we get all this Babylon stuff, you know, we get all the nations, the many waters, the spiritual adultery, blah, 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 the great whore, and all this stuff. Again, that looks just weird. It looks abstract. It looks like none of these things have any relationship to each other at all, but they all do, because there are ways of describing allegiance to other gods instead of Yahweh. There are ways of describing the Deuteronomy 32 rebellion, all this stuff. I want you to be thinking the rest of the time how Psalm 82 links the judgment of the gods over the nations with not only these themes, but also the whole theme of injustice, you know, social, economic injustice, just the chaos that the gods sow in the nations. Remember Psalm 82, where what is God so angry at the gods for? Now, he has allotted the gods to the other nations. He has abandoned the nations because he's judging them for the whole Tower of Babel episode. He's fragmented them through the languages. You know, we all know the Tower of Babel story, okay? What we miss is the allotment of the gods to the nations and the nations to these other gods. If you've read Unseen Realm, this is old hat by now. Deuteronomy 4, 19 through 20. Deuteronomy 17, 1 through 3. Deuteronomy 29, 23 through 26. You get this allotment language of the host of heaven. The host of heaven are called Elohim in these passages. They are called gods, and these gods have been allotted to the nations. God has taken Israel. This is the language of Deuteronomy 4, 19 and 20. He has taken Israel to be his own, and he has abandoned, he has judged the other ones. You get to Deuteronomy 32, when the Most High divides up the nations, he divides them up according to the number of the sons of God. Israel is Yahweh's own portion. And again, it's a judgment. And so what happens next in the biblical story is that God says, okay, we're done now. You don't get to set up your own religious system where you build a ziggurat. It's part of a temple complex. And then I come to you and say, what do you want? Okay, you're doing exactly the opposite I told you to do. We repeated the Edenic mandate. You're supposed to disperse all over the earth and reclaim it for me. We're here to try to kickstart Eden again, folks. And you don't seem to get it. Fine. Let's see if you get this. I'm out of here. I am no longer having a relationship with you. I'm going to allot you to these lesser members of the heavenly host. And then next, I'm going to go, and I'm going to go call this dude Abraham, and his wife, and I'm going to raise up through them a new Adam, a new humanity, a new people for me. Because that's why I started Eden. I want a human family. You don't seem willing. So long. Okay, now we're going to start it again. We're going to do it again. And Abraham and Sarah are perfect because she cannot have children. This is wonderful. Because when I enable her to have a child, no one on the face of the earth is going to be able to deny that the only reason this people exists, Israel, is because of a supernatural act on my behalf. I get the credit. Okay, I'm the creator. Nobody else is. And so this is what God does. Now, when he does it, he makes Abram a promise in Genesis 12, chapter right after Babel, and says, now look, it's going to be, you know, I'm going to promise you all sorts of things. I'm going to give you a land. I'm going to multiply you. You're going to be like the stars. And, you know, and we've had, you know, David Burnett on in the past talking about the star language. It's not just quantity. It refers to a quality that this is the people who are going to be with me in a new Eden. You know, it's the language of glorification. It's not just quantity, but quality. But you know what? Those nations that I just divorced, we're not forgetting them. Because one day, just like I told Eve that one day she's going to have a human child, there's going to be a human being that extends from her lineage who will be born, who will undo the effects of this disaster that happened in the Garden of Eden. So just like I told her that, I'm going to tell you something. One of your seed is going to be the key, going to be the conduit through which all of these other nations are going to be brought back into the family. I will have my people from them. Okay, I'm not going to, you know, abandon them permanently. They're on the shelf now, but I'm going to use you to bring them back, to bring the nations back. And this is the Old Testament, you know, story. Now, what happens is that the gods who are appointed over these other nations, and since God is still interested in them, I mean, if you're a member of some other nation in Old Testament times, there's no rule against you joining Israel, except for one. You must abandon other gods. You must turn your back on all other gods. You must confess that Yahweh is the God of all gods, and that he has entered into a covenant relationship with these people known as Israel. And when I join them, I will worship no other. I will trust no other. I will presume that no other deity will, you know, rescue me from Sheol. I will presume that he is the God of all gods, and that only he is capable of rescuing me from death, ultimately. This is what you must believe, and there's no rule against anybody believing it. We know that there are pagans and Gentiles in the Old Testament who come over, they switch sides. There's no barrier to that other than turning their backs on their gods. So, you know, this is what's going on. Well, the gods of the nations, their strategy becomes, okay, well, we'll just seduce Yahweh's people into abandoning him. We're going to turn them into idolaters. And the people under our charge, we're going to enslave them. We're going to make them dependent on us. We're going to sow so much chaos in their lives. We're going to sow so much fear in their lives that they're going to be so paralyzed with fear that they wouldn't think of leaving us because we'll retaliate. We'll destroy them. You know, it's a fear-based, power-based, abuse-based, chaos-based system. And if you read Psalm 82, this is what you get in verses 2 through 5. This is what they're doing, and this is why God is angry. So I want you to be thinking about all that as a background, because when you head into the rest of Revelation 17 and 18, there are a number of places where it describes the economic, you know, injustice. And what I mean by that is ways that those who hold power enslave people economically through what they can eat, through what they own or what they don't own. They create economic dependence on this. You know, you go to Revelation 17, 1 through 2, you know, come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters. With the kings of the earth, they have committed sexual immorality. Okay, so they hold the power brokers in their hands, okay? You get to Revelation 18, 2 and 3. That's Revelation 17. Here's Revelation 18, 2 and 3. Let's just go to verse 1. Then after this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, the earth was made bright with his glory. And he called out with a mighty voice, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast. For all nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality. And the kings of the earth have committed immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth." They're now all of a sudden we throw in the merchants. Again, the people who will use wealth to victimize and enslave others, okay? "The merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living." So there we add the economic element. You keep reading in chapter 18, you get to verse 5. You know, we see it again. "For her sins, Babylon's sins are heaped on heaven, and God for her iniquity, her body herself and back others. Repay her deeds, mix a double portion for her in the cup she mixed. As she glorified herself and lived in luxury, so give her like a measure of torment and mourning, since in her heart she says, 'I sit as a queen. I am no widow. The mourning I shall never see.'" You know, M-O-U-R. You know, she's not going to see disaster. "For this reason, her plagues will come in a single day, death and mourning and famine. She will be burned up with fire, for mighty is the Lord God who has judged her." You go down a little bit further. You get verses 10 through 17. Look at how Babylon is described. "Alas, you great city, you mighty city Babylon, for in a single hour your judgment has come. And the merchants," there they are again, "of the earth weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore. Cargo of gold, silver, jewels, pearls, fine linen, purple cloth, silk, scarlet cloth, all kinds of scented wood." I mean, there's just a long grocery list of spices. I mean, this is the economic center because Babylon was the dominant world empire. Okay, let me just be real simple. You know, it's like Thomas Jefferson said, okay, the more that the government gives you, the more it can take away. Okay, when you are under its authority, when you are dependent on it, it will strangle you. You have now given it the power to crush you and to control you and manipulate you. This is what, you know, we live in America, but we're still fond of saying, you know, things like, and it's true. When is the last time government surrendered power? It doesn't. And this is why economic power and other kinds of manipulative power are used in the Bible, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, and here in Revelation. Revelation picks up all these themes. I'm reading the book of Revelation. Reading Revelation 18. So this is why these things are referenced, because when a system of power owns you, you're trapped. Okay, you're going to suffer greatly to ever get out from under it. It will not allow it. It will not tolerate you excusing yourself from the arrangement. It owns you. And it's an abuse of power. It's an opportunity for chaos. It's an opportunity to exploit and destroy. And this is why the book of Revelation casts Babel in these economic terms. And that goes right back to Psalm 82. It goes right back there. This is the kind of abuse of people that God does not want. God is not in favor of coercive, abusive power exercised by people over other people, and he's not in favor of it because ultimately, when it is evil and coercive and abusive, ultimately, the ones driving the bus aren't necessarily the human power brokers, because behind the human power brokers, there's a more sinister intelligence that wants to destroy, that wants to enslave, that wants you to worship them. This is, again, this is why the nations, both in the in Psalm 82, Revelation, and lots of other passages, I mean, there's tons of passages like this in the Old Testament. This is why the nations are described this way and why the gods of those nations get looped into it. It's all one huge chaotic evil system that is aligned against, ultimately, the people of God. So, you know, why, again, let's go back to the why question. This is what I think it's really about, because where is all this leading? Chapter 15, 16, 17, 18. Well, 19, you know, we're going to get, you know, we're going to get Armageddon. We're going to get the return of the Lord. We're going to get the day of the Lord, you know, enacted. We're going to get all this evil. We're going to get the beast dealt with. Now, think of it this way. If this is really about God against the nations, if this is really about the Psalm 82 judgment of the gods, the death of the gods finally coming to pass, think about the purpose of that. Think about the purpose of that. Revelation 17 is an integral part of the day of the Lord judgment of the gods and the reclaiming of the earth. Why? For the re-inheritance of the Messiah. The earth is going to be wiped clean of chaos. The earth is being readied again to be sacred space for the true God and the King. That is ultimately what this is about. The earth must be made fit. Okay? It must be made fit for the reoccupation of the true King in a new Eden with his own family and his reconstituted council, going back to Eden, and that's us. So, again, we need to pay attention to the theological backdrop behind all of these sorts of descriptions. It's not about who has the best weaponry. It's not about, you know, who has the best army. It's ultimately about the gods getting what they deserve, the beast getting what it deserves. It's about the annihilation of chaos. Chaos must be annihilated. It must be eliminated in totality. Because this time when the Lord returns, chapter 19, okay, he's going to be occupying a new Eden. And in this case, the new Eden is global. The whole world, every nation, every square inch of the place has to be readied and retooled, refit to be sacred space, because he is showing up. Okay? He is reoccupying. So again, we need to think a little bit bigger picture about these things. I know they look strange, they look disparate, they look like they're not related. They're all related. They all fit together. Again, if you can take the bird's eye view and look down and look where John is drawing all this stuff. And the key here is the Babylon. The key here is the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. And then the imagery makes sense. And the end game makes sense. The ultimate conflict, as the players are taking sides, they make sense. So we're going to end there. And in the next time, again, we're going to obviously get into chapter 19. We might get into 20. I don't know yet. But this is ultimately what it's about. It's about reoccupation. It's about making the world a new Eden. It's about making it fit for sacred space, because the King is about ready to show up. And then everything comes full circle. You know, Psalm 82 judgment, the death of the gods, the whole thing is going to come full circle.
All right, Mike. Two loaded chapters, that was. I mean, I'm ready for him to come on down. Let's get it going. Let's just get it going. No, yeah, wouldn't complain if that happens.
Oh, I know. But, absolutely, you know. I'm not going to go. You know, we all have these things that we want to see happen before the Lord returns, but all those things are sort of off my list, you know.
Yeah. I wouldn't mind just throwing my list away and just having them come on down. Let's get it going.
Yeah.
But
No, for real.
All right, Mike. Well, yeah, for real. Good episode. We appreciate you taking time to fit us in, because we know it takes its toll.
Hey, we're gonna plug away.
All right, I like it. Sounds good, Mike. All right. Well, our prayers are still with you. We hope you have a good week. I appreciate everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.